This is Alan Sheenan, MD, Society of the Self and the Self of Society, Fairy Tales, Dreams, and Deep Community, April 12, 1996, Tape 1 of 2.
I couldn't come to be part of the presentation. So it's collaboration. We wanted the process to reflect the product. Well, there's a lot of discussion about society and social issues and political issues and sociology, political science, and so on. So it's refreshing to take a very simple approach through the view of fairy tales, and also, as we'll see, through dreams, too. Now, it turns out that fairy tales about community or cooperation are fairly uncommon. In looking through all these fairy tales, it was hard to find them. That's probably because most fairy tales are about an individual protagonist and usually reflect an individual psychology. Stories about a group or a community or people cooperating are much less common. It turns out also that these stories about community and cooperation are most common in tribal cultures, or what anthropologists call small-scale cultures, which would be based on the family or a small village. Basically, societies which have face-to-face contact with everybody. And these stories about cooperation are not common in large-scale societies, such as Western culture, which is based on a state or a city, where you have lots of people and you don't have face-to-face knowledge of everybody. I think this is rather dismaying, that these stories of cooperation come from much older cultures and not from our more recent ones. But I think the reasons are, you can probably guess, fairy tales that come from large-scale cultures, like Western culture, usually focus on issues of power. How do you get power? Who has power? It's like the hero defeats the evil villain who has power, then the hero has power. Because these cultures have a central government, usually, and the means to enforce the rules by police or army. In small-scale cultures, they don't have a central authority. Often there's a chief, but often it's not hereditary. It's just chosen by the person who seems to be the best at leading. And leaders are functional, that one man might lead the hunt, another woman might be the one everybody goes to solve disputes because she's the best at that, and another woman might lead the gathering group, and another man might lead fighting for defense. In these societies, then, there's no fixed rules or fixed hierarchy, and so the question always comes up of, why should I cooperate with you? So cooperation and community is a very live issue for them. I'll be also addressing dreams, and to show that dreams, although we usually think of as revealing individual psychological issues, also reflect societal and community issues. This will become clear as we go through folk tales and then move on to dreams. Tomorrow in the workshop, we'll be going deeper into the further fairy tales and dreams, and then also going on to visions, whether they come up in vision quests or active imagination, and using an example of Christiana Morgan, whose visions Jung analyzed in the vision seminar. It turns out, though, he actually edited out the most interesting ones, so we'll be discussing tomorrow one of the visions he edited out. Well, the mystics often tell us that we are all one, and that's what New Age people say, we are all one. Well, these folk tales will reveal how the self and society do interpenetrate and reflect each other. I should start with a caveat. First of all, folk tales, fairy tales are folk tales, so they're handed down from generation to generation, and so they reflect the society in which they're most recently transmitted. So we might need to overlook some of the specific things like, you know, a king or hunting or something like that, because the fairy tales also have the archetypal timeless dimension. The social elements that appear is analogous to the day residue in dreams. It's the events that happen in the day that appear in your dreams, but they're just the material that the unconscious uses to convey some other message. The second caveat is that I'll be giving some interpretations of these stories, but I want to emphasize that your interpretations are just as important. These are folk stories, so they belong to everybody, and there's no one right interpretation. This is particularly important when they deal with community issues with many different political interpretations. So I'll just say from the outset that obviously I have a certain political bent which you may not agree with, so be sure to speak up. Well, rather than talk about the stories, I thought I'd tell you some. That's the fun part. And I thought I'd begin with one that would be familiar, because it would seem it follows most familiar fairy tales, but it edges into stories about community. This is an Italian story called Massino and the Witch. Massino is the name of a guy. A long time ago, in a distant land, there was a village of people who prided themselves on being peaceful. They didn't argue among themselves, they didn't make arguments with their neighboring villages, and they were quite calm and peaceful. But one day, into this village, was born a little boy. He was so tiny and weak that his parents were afraid he would die soon. So they bathed him in red wine, which had been heated with a red-hot horseshoe, and this was to give him strength. Then they put him in swaddling clothes and put him in the husk of a chestnut. He was that small. And since chestnuts are bitter like medicine, this was to give him wisdom. Well, they named him Massino, and he grew up to be the cleverest, smartest little boy that you ever saw. In fact, he was so smart that as he grew older, people would come to him for advice and ask him how to solve problems. Well, when he became a young man, he decided he wanted to see the world, and so he joined the army and left his village. Well, everybody was sad to see him go, especially after he left when little problems and disputes started cropping up. And they thought, well, how are we going to solve these? So they would postpone the problems and say, we'll wait till Massino comes back and he'll tell us what we should do. Well, one day, a farmer took his cows out to the pasture in the fields to graze as he usually did, and for some reason, he passed out. When he came to, some of his cattle were missing. He was horrified. He looked around but couldn't find any evidence of a cattle thief. Well, the next day, the same thing happened to another farmer. He went to the meadows. Something made him pass out, fall asleep. When he woke up, some of his cattle were gone. Well, this happened day after day to all the farmers who went out. And so they got together and said, we have to look for this cattle rustler. I mean, this is terrible. So they searched through the meadow and the forest and everywhere nearby. But all they could find were boot prints, little tufts of hair that had stuck on the bushes, and hairpins. And when the farmers saw this, they were terrified. It is Miss Alina the witch who has been stealing our cattle, they said. Where's her hairpins and her boots? And so they didn't take the animals out to the pasture anymore. They were frightened that she would cast a spell on them, make them pass out and take their cattle, or do worse things. But the cattle, of course, had to eat, and so they got thinner and thinner, staying in the barn. So a farmer had to take his cattle out, and then he would pass out in the pasture somewhere, and a cattle would disappear. So they kept losing cattle, and the cattle kept getting thinner, and they were caught between a rock and a hard place. So they decided they better ask for help from the count, in the local nobleman. They sent a delegation up to the castle on the hill, knocked on the door, soldiers opened it, and led them to the count. And he sat in a silver chair, had a long beard, wore velvet clothes, and ate from the golden dishes. And he growled at the farmers, "What do you want?" Obviously, the count didn't like being bothered. So the farmers explained, "We've come to get your aid because Miss Alina the witch is stealing all our cattle." And the count said, "Don't be ridiculous. There's no such thing as Miss Alina the witch. It's just a superstition. Why don't you folks get with it? This is, you know, modern times. Who believes in witches now?" But they explained their cattle were disappearing and their, you know, these hair and hairpins and boot prints. It had to be Miss Alina the witch. Well, the count refused to believe them, said they should grow up. Obviously, it was somebody among them who was stealing the cattle. And then he motioned to his soldiers, and so the farmers had to leave. Well, they were desperate because each day, whenever they took their cattle out, the farmer would pass out and cattle would disappear, and if they stayed in, the cattle starved. So finally they got together and said, "We have to write a letter to Massino and ask him to come back because we're desperate. We need help." So they wrote a letter to Massino. It took several weeks to get there because the internet was also heavily trafficked in those days too. And it took several weeks for Massino to come back. Well, when he appeared in the village, everybody rejoiced. They built a big bonfire, got all the wine out, and celebrated his return. And they again explained the problem with Miss Alina the witch. Massino said, "On my travels, I've seen people as tall as houses and as short as stools. I've seen people who live high in trees and people who live underground, people who eat rocks for dinner and people who eat just air. But I've never seen a people as sorry as you." The villagers were a little embarrassed because they felt somewhat ashamed that nobody dared face Miss Alina the witch. So Massino heard the story and then he said, "I have three questions only." First, he turned to the barber and said, "Barber, how has your business been this past month?" The barber thought this was a weird question. Everybody else thought this was a weird question. But the barber said, "Well, business has been usual. Everyone comes to my shop and I cut their hair and trim their beards. So everybody has short, neat hair. But look." Massino looked. Everybody had short, neat hair. So Massino turned to the cobbler and asked, "How has business been this past month?" And the cobbler said, "It's been terrible with everybody losing cattle, the cattle getting thin, we're all poor, nobody can afford to buy new boots, can hardly afford to repair boots. Most of us are just wearing straw sandals now." Massino looked, and it was true. And finally, Massino turned to the rope maker and said, "Well, how has business been for you this past month?" And the rope maker said, "Well, that's a weird thing. I've been more busy than ever in my life. As soon as I finish making a coil of rope, somebody comes and buys it. I can't keep up with the demand." Massino nodded, and then he said, "Well, I'm going off into the forest and look for Miss Alina, your witch. But be sure to have lots of wine when I come back so we can celebrate." Well, all the villagers were happy he was going out to get Messalina the witch, but they were frightened. What if, you know, she cast a spell on him, turned into a frog or something? So everybody waited around the bonfire, trembling with fear. And a few hours later, Massino returned, dragging the count with him, all tied up. And the count was struggling and struggling. And Massino said, "Here is your Messalina the witch. Look, he tied his long beard up over his head so he looks like a woman, and those are the hairpins he used which fell along the way, and it was his hair that got stuck on the bushes, and he's been stealing your cattle all this time." And everybody was amazed. "How did you know this?" And Massino said, "Well, obviously, somebody was using the rope, so I figured they were using it to get the cattle away somewhere. So it couldn't be a witch or a ghost, because they wouldn't need cattle, they just use magic. So I thought, well, it's human. It has to be somebody nearby because they're buying rope. Could it be someone from the village?" "Well, no. Nobody had boots now, and nobody had long hair. So it had to be somebody else, but someone nearby. And who else would do this but the count?" Well, all the villagers wanted to kill the count immediately, but Massino wouldn't let them do that. So he let the count go on one condition, that the count return all the cattle with a few extra thrown in, and the count had to clean out everybody's stables, and the count, every night from then on, had to go into the forest, cut firewood, and bring it back for everybody in the village. And so all the farmers and Massino lived together in peace and happiness the rest of their days. Any thoughts or reactions to this story? The question was, how do you know the count will keep his word? This is a fairy tale. But presumably, Massino would think of something. Massino or the count? Presumably he grew large enough to be a soldier in the army. But the story begins as a typical hero tale with Massino born really tiny, and so a miraculous birth, and then he's almost killed at birth like Hercules and Moses and other heroes, and then grows up to be this remarkable person. But then there's a slight difference in the story. It's not just a hero story, because it now involves the community of the village and how they cope with the situation. Yes?
Was the count happy at the end also?
That's a good question. The story doesn't answer that part. Now, the question would be, what would you think? Was he happy that he changed his evil ways, or?
Well, within the mythology, talking about it, he would be.
He was part of the community. I suppose we could ask Michael Milliken if he had, if he felt happy now. Yes. Yes, the comment was that she was expecting a story of cooperation, like the fairy tales of the seven brothers or seven companions or things like that. And here instead you have a hero saving the dorky plebeians.
Yeah.
Well, I think I started with this, which is basically a hero story, to move into showing how there are different alternatives. But the paradigm is basically there is somebody who's smarter than we are, who's more powerful, who's braver, who has the resources to solve a problem that we can't. That's certainly a common view that we have. It's a paradigm in lots of groups and lots of societies, and it's typical of hierarchical societies. But it also applies to family dynamics, because this is the normal family dynamic, that the children look up to the parents to solve problems. And you get problems if one of the parents is like the count, stealing from the children. But the same kind of dynamics also occur in the psyche, because in many ways we assume that the ego is supposed to be in charge of things. It's supposed to balance all the complexes and make sure things get done and keep us on time or appointments and stuff like that. So that there too there's that hero paradigm. And in many ways the current concept of the ego is basically the hero. Any further thoughts, reactions? Yeah, the comment was that
the area, there's no real reason other than he's a hero to think that he's necessarily that much more
the comment was the villagers expected Massino to solve everything and didn't make an attempt themselves. And that's actually a very common dynamic, isn't it? I mean, if you think about your workplace or a committee you've been on, often people don't do anything, expect a leader will appear. It's so common, it's sort of like an instinct or something.
But it's even more than that, they fall asleep when they go out there.
That's a small detail I forgot to mention. That the count carried a club and he just hit the farmer in the head. A small detail I forgot to mention. Well, I should explain that this is the world... this is the world premiere of these stories. I haven't told them before, so I might miss some little details like this. So bear with me. But it works either way, as you point out. And I think it brings up an important point that often there is something going on in a group process that makes everybody unconscious or not want to challenge what's going on. And notice that the people assume it's Miscellina the witch, although apparently they've never seen the witch before. I mean, it's pure projection. And nobody suspects that it might be the count, you know, the nobleman who's supposed to be honorable and stuff. So they idealize him and don't realize that actually Miscellina is his shadow running around. The comment was, who was buying all the rope? Was the count coming in to buy all the rope? Presumably he was sending all his men to do it. The story doesn't explain the details, but I presume since, you know, the implication is a different person came each time.
It's interesting that the count didn't just say, yeah, it's the witch, to get it done off himself. And it's interesting that they didn't let him talk it out of it.
Yes, the comment was that it's interesting that the count didn't go along with their belief that Miscellina was behind it so as to keep himself in the clear, and that they went ahead in anyway and with their belief that Miscellina was behind it. I think that's a good point. In a sense, the count wanted to get caught almost. I mean, he could have done more to put them on the false track.
Oh, right. He could have said, oh, yes, Miscellina, witch. You bet. Then I bet she's in that forest over there in the next county.
Or you could have said, give me 50 cattle, I'll make a sacrifice, and we'll get rid of her. No, I think, yes. Yes. That's a good question. Do you have any candidates for who'd be the count? Well, I suppose one example would be a Nixon not destroying his tapes immediately and keeping them around. It's like, you know, he let something go on that eventually was his downfall, and the count could have gone along with the Miscellina, so he wouldn't get caught.
Oh, yes, and that's what it's all saying.
Yes. Yes. That's a good point. You could imagine if there were wives running around, they would say, hey, wait a moment. But it's true. It's like this is a male story, isn't it?
The cattle
might have been female. Some of them would have been. Now, it's interesting the Massino gets rid of the count as a villain, but he doesn't change the basic structure, which is the hero structure, looking to somebody else to solve a problem. And the question is, are there alternatives to that? But I wanted to go further into the story and try a little exercise as a way of using the story to gain some more insight. So this would be sort of like active imagination. Just close your eyes a moment and relax, if you want to try this experiment. Just take a few breaths and let all your tensions go away. And picture yourself now at work, in your office or whatever setting you're in. and you've just finished an important job and you're really proud. All of a sudden, something whacks you on the head, knocks you out, and when you come to groggily, you see that all your work has been stolen. What's your reaction? What comes up for you?
Wait.
Why don't we wait? So take a few moments till some drama unfolds. And then when you're ready, you can just open your eyes. And then think for a moment, keeping those images you had, who is the count at work? And who is the Masino you hope will come? And then turn to the person next to you and then share what images came up and what ideas came up about who might be the count and who might be Masino at work. Maybe take about 5 minutes for each person. Don't forget to switch so that each person gets to say what happened. Well, why don't you take a few more minutes to finish up? A couple minutes to... Well, why don't we get started again? Any comments or questions? Reactions? Anybody want to share what came up for them? Yes. I think that's an important point, that Miscellina is a shadow figure. It's easy to project the evil in somebody else, and that it's important to us to ask who the count is in us, or when have you been a count, stealing things from people who are less fortunate.
Yeah, I had one that happened at work. I actually sort of unfolded it today. Last night I started a program running and built a work in progress sign on the computer. And then a little note saying to save it, because you have to save the output before you exit this application or else you lose it. But sometimes people at work want to use it, and not know how to save it. They'll just exit. But I said, I'll go ask someone who knows. And I came in today, and it was that the output wasn't saved, and someone didn't use the computer. And I went to the program analyst and asked her what happened. She said, oh, no, it was like that when I found it. I came in at 6:30, so some trouble used it last night. So I asked someone who was here last night, a friend of mine. And he said, oh, yeah, I wouldn't use it. But when I used it, it was already exited from the application. And I realized when he told me that I had put in a statement that made it exit inadvertently.
Oh.
So I, in a sense, he was, the boy.
Masino.
And I was the count, but didn't know it.
Well, you're the count and the village people.
Yeah.
That's a nice illustration of our first reaction is, who's to blame? Oh, it was me. Now, this exercise you can also do on your own. We don't have time tonight, but another version of this would be to picture yourself in your family of origin, say at dinner or something, and then somebody whacks you on the head. And you wake up, and all the food's gone, everything that you in your room is gone. And the question would be, who's the count in your family? and who's Massino and who's Michelina. We won't go into that because it would be a little hard to share. Any last comments or questions on this story before we go on to another one? Yeah, the comment was the villagers go to the count for help, but he turns out to be the villain. Well, I think actually the story's been very astute here. It actually probably reflects historical fact that people would look up to the noble person, leader, to help them when they're actually ripping them off. It doesn't say, but maybe the count was a lawyer or a politician or something. But even today, we look up to a lot of people and later find out they were dishonest. And we want to believe that they are heroes or leaders. Another issue that comes up is there's a basic problem in the hero paradigm in that what if Massino grows older and becomes like the count? He decides he wants to be wealthy and starts cheating. And was the count Massino, when he was young, somebody who was helping others and then turned into a tyrant? So there's a problem with the hero paradigm that it's prone to abuse. Yes? I'm sorry, I didn't hear.
The instincts will always feel like something, so it's not surprising. That was
So the cattle were representing the instinctual or feeling side. Yes. Yes. Well, why don't I go on to another story? This one introduces a different way, a different model of leadership or community. The community in the story of Massino is basically everybody gathering around a hero to solve their problem. This story is a Native American one and is called How Coyote Brought Fire to the People. Long ago, all the animals and all the people lived without fire. They ate their food raw, they shivered in the winter, and stumbled around at night in the dark. But there was a group that did have fire, and they were the Skookums. They lived high up in the mountains in the ice and snow, and they refused to let anyone else have fire, because they were afraid if any of the animals got fire, they would be as powerful as the Skookums, and the Skookums wouldn't stand for that. Sound familiar? Well, one day, as all the animals were stumbling in the dark, eating their raw food and shivering, Coyote came by. So the animals came up to him and said, "Coyote, Coyote, please, can you get fire for us?" And Coyote said, "Well, I hear the Skookums up there have some, so I'll go take a look." So Coyote trotted off up the mountain, up to the snow, and kind of prowled around. And he discovered that the Skookums were just three. They're just three Skookums. Well, let's go ahead with a couple of exercises. I'm going to cut down the number of exercises so we can get through the material. Now, the story doesn't say what a Skookum looks like. So close your eyes a moment and take a couple deep breaths and picture yourself either at your workplace or at home. And you go to a closet to get something out. You open it, and there is a Skookum. What does a Skookum look like? What do they smell like? What do you do? Just see what images come up. And when you're ready, you can just open your eyes. Well, even if you're not ready, open your eyes. What? Anyone want to share what came up for them, or what images or thoughts about the Skookums at work or at home? Ooh. What did the Skookums look like? Or it could be just one. Yeah.
Big and bad.
Big and bad. Ah. Small and cute. Ah.
Mine was big enough so that it was like crammed into the closet.
Mm.
Like that was the scariest one. And it was kind of, so it was like punching. And it had real strong, wiry arms and hairy and it had kind of claws. And,
Sort of
like strong, like
ape-like
arms. Pretty scary skookum. Yeah, it wasn't as scary as a ghost.
mine looked like a huge witch, probably dressed all in black. It was also kind of crouched in the closet. I mean, it was so big, it was actually taller than the closet. But he said, what did it smell like? And it smelled kind of like old moldy,
there's a poster that I've seen of like the women's heads with these leopard bodies.
Mm.
It's a very famous poster. That's the first thing that came to mind. So they're very sleek, actually, and they have like a little choker on. It's like it's not unlike the other animals, the way they're pictured.
Huh.
Just.
And the crucial question is again. How do these skookums appear at home and at work? Well, let's try another brief exercise. So again, close your eyes if you'd like to. And picture yourself as one of the animals waiting in your position, and you know that your turn is coming up. You can see the animal ahead of you rushing down, followed by the skookums. And then that animal throws the flaming torch towards you. What do you do? What's it like? And again, when you're ready, you can just open your eyes. Well, anybody want to share what came up for them?
Well, for some reason, I'm the fox that takes this, and I guess I'm running through the forest. And it's frightening because those skookums are coming, but it's also exciting, and I feel like I'm on an element. I can find my way around through these things, and somehow it may elude them and went out. So there's more of a thrill of doing something like this and being part of it, but also a thrill of eluding this powerful force. But each time I think about this, I think about perhaps the dreams are just probably that they you always feel like you can't quite get away, and they're catching up to the end, or you're slowing down, as the flyers used to do in dreams as a child. I think there's a reason for this, but I guess that's a childhood part of me, and so it's afraid of catching up to something. But I think of that as an adult.
That's a thrill.
They're not going to really catch me.
To take it up so you won't get eaten by the skookums.
This put me up to the gazelle, and it was really exhilarating. It was full of pride. And then it just, heart started beating, and exhaustion came. It was like gratitude that there was. I guess that was the confidence that there would be. Just the ultimate gratitude. And what it got.
And And again, you might ask yourself, when have you experienced this at work or in your family? When did you not take the torch? Or when did you drop it? And what was it like to pass it on? Was it hard to pass it on? So these are some of the things you can do working with these stories, because they have a lot of depth to them. But we have to trot on to something else now, like Coyote. Any last comments before we go on to the third story? Okay, this story, you can tell where it comes from, because the title is Why the Platypus is Special. The story goes like this. Long ago, in the dream time, the animals were busy choosing their totems. The land animals all gathered together, the wallabies, the koalas, the dingoes, and they said, gee, you know, we're the smartest of all animals, all creatures, so why don't we form a clan and we'll be the number one clan, because we're so smart and we can do everything, and we're special, only we have fur. Well, the birds had also been gathering together, and they said, well, we're the ones who can fly, we see the farthest, we know the most of what's going on, so obviously we're the best of all creatures, so let's form a clan and we'll be the best. And the emu said, well, I can't fly. But then he added, oh, but I can run as fast as most of you can fly. And besides, I lay eggs, too. So, okay, it was okay. The emu would be part of this prestigious bird clan. Well, meanwhile, the water creatures got together, the crocodile, the turtle, the fish, and so on. And they said, well, we know all the secrets of the deeps, and our wisdom is so deep, we are surely the best of all creatures. So we'll form a clan, and we're number one. Well, meanwhile, back at the land animal convention, the mammals and marsupials, somebody said, oh, what about the platypus? They have fur like we do, and they nurse their young like we do, even if they have that disgusting habit of laying an egg. Well, everybody discussed and agreed, well, the platypus had fur, and only, you know, smart animals had fur, so the platypus should join them. So they sent a delegation to the platypus in its little burrow by the stream, and the platypus was surprised. He usually didn't get visitors, and they asked, oh, well, would you like to join our clan, the land animals? And the platypus said, well, I'm flattered. I had never thought of this. It's such a great honor. Let me talk about it with my family, and then I'll tell you tomorrow. Well, the birds had gotten together in their convention, too, and they said, well, what about the platypus? Everybody was thinking about the platypus. They lay eggs like we do and hatch them like we do, and they also have a bill like we do, so we have to include the platypus as a bird. So they sent a delegation to invite the platypus to join the prestigious clan of birds. And the platypus was surprised that somebody else had come to visit him that day, and he said, oh, I mean, this is such a great honor, I have to think about it, so let me ask my family and I'll tell you tomorrow. Well, in their little convention, the water creatures said, well, you know, the platypus lives in water like we do, spends most of his time in water, swims, and knows all the secrets of the deep, so we have to have the platypus join our prestigious group. They sent a delegation there, and the platypus said, oh my, people are busy today, but I really have to think about this. It's such a great honor to be invited to join the clan of the crocodiles and the turtles and fish. So platypus went and talked to his family, and they discussed it, and they couldn't figure out which clan to join. So Mr. Platypus and Mrs. Platypus decided they'd go to their friends, the Spiny Anteater. And they went over there and discussed it, and Mr. and Mrs. Spiny Anteater said, well, maybe you shouldn't join any clan. And the platypi thought this was a great idea. So they went back to their home, and the platypus sent word to all the clans to come to a big meeting by the river, and all of them were to come, and they were to come in peace. They weren't to fight or argue, and he would give them his answer. Well, the land mammals and marsupials were delighted. They said, well, obviously the platypus will join us, and all the other animals will see that we are the best because the platypus wants to join us. And the birds thought, oh, well, obviously the platypus will join us, so everybody will see we're the best, and the water creatures thought that. So the next morning, all the animals went to the burrow by the platypus, and he came out and said, well, you know, I've been talking with my family, my wife, and the spiny anteater, and I've decided that I can't join any one clan, any clan of yours. All the animals were shocked. How could they turn down, you know, their prestigious offer? And the platypus went on to explain, well, I realized that I'm like each of you, but like, you know, but different. And I wondered, well, how come I'm this way? And it occurred to me that Byame, the creator, made me this way as a reminder that we are all one family, that when you see me, you have to remember that I'm similar to you and I'm similar to all the other animals and that we're all related. All the animals thought about this and thought, well, this is very wise. And so they agreed to that. And so to this day, whenever they come across a platypus, they remember that Byame created the platypus to remind everybody that we're all one family. Any reactions to this one? Unfortunately, it can only come from Australia. That's the only place where the platypus is. I should mention just an explanation. The spiny anteater is the only other animal in the same genus as the platypus. That it also has fur and lays eggs. That they're the only two surviving examples of the monotremes, as they're called. Now, the story is quite fascinating because it has the animals getting together and they're forming clans. So they're forming a cooperative community among themselves through kinship. And of course, that's a basic kind of community is kin, relatives, and so on. And the story illustrates the negative side of that, of vying for prestige and putting other people outside or putting them down. And that, of course, happens with religious groups or ideological groups, that they come together as a kin, but everybody else is outside or foreign. It's interesting also that the animals are vying for prestige, not property or territory. And that reflects the Aboriginal tradition that they didn't have much property and were nomadic. But I think it also reflects that prestige is one of the most basic things we compete for, even before possessions. And it's probably related biologically to the alpha male and alpha female system. And it just comes over to this. The question is how to deal with that strong element for one group to be the most prestigious. And the platypus introduces a fascinating answer, which is the reference to the creator. In essence, the platypus is saying, he could have said, well, I'm similar to all of you, so just remember that we're all similar. But no, he specifically brings in the creator God. And I think this is an important point, that it's only a religious or spiritual element that can bring counteract this kinship force or this competition for prestige, that those are very powerful forces, and so only something equally powerful can counteract that. And so that's why the platypus does refer to the creator. It's a very interesting story here. Any thoughts or reactions, comments? Now the platypus is also a marginal animal, like coyote, because it doesn't fit any particular group. I mean, it's sort of a freak. And again, so from the marginal area comes wisdom, in this case, the notion of the unity. The platypus is also, I don't know if the Aborigines thought this, but certainly in modern biologists consider it a very primitive creature that arose, you know, before, right around the times that the reptiles appeared and mammals differentiated millions of years ago. So it brings up the issue of something marginal and primitive contains an important insight. And so the question arises, what would that be in your psyche, in the community of your psyche? What would that be in your family? And what would that be in society? Something that seems primitive, weird, funny, but has some important wisdom or message. It's a fascinating story with lots of questions that it raises. Some issues that it raised for me, just personal opinion, was a viewpoint of, well, secular humanism seems to have forgotten the spiritual core. And that's what all these fundamentalist group remember. And we often think of like the militia or fundamentalists this or fundamentalists that as kind of primitive. But could they be like the platypus? And are they reminding us of something that the secular humanists have forgotten, that spiritual element? Of course, here it's important to distinguish two kinds of religious inspiration. One would be like the platypus, which is an inclusive one. He welcomes everybody. He says, we are all one. It's kind of an ecstatic, outreaching inspiration. The other kind of inspiration is one that focuses down to one thing and just one issue, and it'd be, the negative form would be a paranoia, like we have the only truth, everybody else is heathens or ignorant or something, and going to perish. And the platypus obviously favors the inclusive one. Another way to look at it is the inclusive spiritual energy would be equivalent to the shamanic frenzy, where the shaman goes into a trance and then travels to other worlds. He, in essence, opens his consciousness up to different worlds. Whereas the exclusive fervor would be more like the war dance, where the warriors would dance until they're in a frenzy and they're just concentrated on one thing, which is to kill. And that's the different. It's different from the shaman's frenzy. Any thoughts, comments, reactions? Well, I'll skip the exercise because we're running out of time. I did want to mention about dreams. As you can see from the examples of these folktales, the stories contain reference to group dynamics in general that apply to society, a community, or a group like at work or family, and also to the psyche. And I think most dreams also have those different levels. Although Jungian discussions often focus on how it relates to the individual psyche, I think if you look at dreams, you'll see that there is a connection to things outside, both to the family, to your workplace, or to society. In fact, I would guess that most of you, or a large proportion of you, have had dreams that had something to do with a spouse or a partner, where your dream depicted something or picked up something that you weren't consciously aware of. And similarly, that you have dreams of work that had some message about work that you weren't aware of consciously, but your unconscious was trying to tell you. I think one way to look at it is that the unconscious doesn't make strict divisions between individual, group, and society. It's sort of one big thing and sends messages up in different ways. You see, historically, of course, dreams were considered public events. They weren't interpreted in individual things. A dream usually was interpreted as referring to the future of the whole city or the whole tribe. It was a community property thing. That's what Jung called big dreams. There's a nice example of a dream that illustrates the personal and the societal levels, and it was a man who was an engineer going through a midlife crisis, and he dreamed this, that he was a photographer waiting in a small crowd of photographers around a big building. Then all of a sudden, these huge doors to the building opened, and all these cardinals, you know, Roman Catholic cardinals, came out with their red hats and their red capes and all their ceremonial stuff, and they were carrying a sedan chair, you know, upon which sat a young woman who was dressed in white, and the cardinals were all elated because they had just elected the next pope, which was this woman. But instead of wearing that little white yarmulke that the pope usually has, she had a yarmulke or skull cap with gold sequins on it, so it glittered in the light. And the photographer was amazed at this, so he ran to get a better view to take a picture, and he said that the expression of this woman was one of bewilderment, like, how could this be happening? How could I have been elected pope? Well, on a personal psychological level, the man was dealing with the anima and how he had to shift from this masculine logical world he had lived in as an engineer, not paying attention to feelings, to starting to honor the anima and feelings. But as you can probably imagine, it also has societal or collective import of a shift from the masculine patriarchal tradition, which the College of Cardinals would dramatize, to the feminine principle, which is still surprised that this change could occur. So I think if you looked at your dreams, you'd find that there is this group element or societal element. And I think we actually have time for one more exercise, and that is to think of a dream that was very important to you or struck you somehow, but not too personal, because you want the exercise is to share it with another person. So think of some dream that you'd be willing to share and tell it to the person next to you. And the person next to you is to listen to it and then to think of how that might be a dream about society in general. And then switch turns so that you would listen to the other person's dream. So why don't we take, say, maybe 2.5-3 minutes each person. If you haven't already, switch roles so the other person tells the dream now. Why don't you take a few moments to finish up? Well, shall we all reassemble? Anyone want to mention what came up for them, or comments, questions? Was everyone able to think of some social interpretation for dreams? It's usually hard to think of it yourself. You have to usually hear somebody else's dream. Oh, any comments or reactions? Well, that was the material I wanted to present tonight. Basically using folk tales, fairy tales about community, to illustrate that they introduce new models of leadership or organization different from the hero, patriarch kind of stuff, and that these models of cooperation apply to society or to family or to office situation or to your inside your psyche. And that dreams also reflect these different levels, although we didn't have too much time to go into that. And the intriguing part about the interpenetration of the personal and the social would be that some of your some issues that you may be struggling with may actually come from outside and may not be just a purely personal one. Well, tomorrow we'll be going into other stories and working with dreams more, and also going on to visions, as I mentioned, the use of whatever comes up with active imagination and doing some exercises for that. So, thank you.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright CGU Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.